Police and Shreves by Adam Smith. San stands in the kitchen of the hospital canteen where she works, watching the new girl, Ace. Ace has her back turned to San. Her shoulders are slumped, and she is sighing as she reluctantly butters baguettes. This girl obviously doesn't belong here. She said she'd done this kind of work before. Ice World? Sounds more like a supermarket. But she has the thoroughly fed-up look of someone who's worked here at least a week, not just 3 hours. And then there's her tan. She didn't get that in London. She's travelled. And her muscles. Her instinctive reactions to noises around the kitchen, instantly stiffening out of her slouch. And her suspicious glances at her fellow workers when she thinks they're not looking all seem more military than anything else. Of course, San doesn't belong here herself, at least not in terms of being a native of the planet. She is a Shreve, dropped off on Earth as a youngster with 20 of her brothers and sisters from the mothership that makes its never-ending tour of the suitable planets. Not that you'd ever know this to look at San. Naturally humanoid, albeit pale green and smooth-faced, Shreves have an effortless ability to take on the form of members of the dominant species on the planets where they land. In fact, the form of any individual member of the species. If San wanted, she could easily achieve every one of the things her frustrated human co-workers seem to desire so much. Wealth, beauty, fame. She could assume the form of, say, some supermodel or other, lock the real one in a cupboard, and live out the human's fantasy. Or better still, she could explain everything to the supermodel, Shreves are not malicious, and come to some agreement about sharing photo shoot and party attending duties. But of course, being a Shreve, such desires mean nothing to San. Like all the members of her race, all she craves is heat, humidity, and close proximity to electrical appliances. Her job in the kitchen by day and her evening job in a laundrette gives San an ideal life. And on her days off, she lies contentedly on the carpet next to the radiator in her sparsely furnished flat, her body pleasantly full of the accumulated electricity of the working week, and her mind happily conversing with the other Shreves on the planet by telepathic link. Shreves enjoy a good gossip. The form San assumes at work, and at home if a human should come to the door, is not based on anyone in particular, and is her own creation. It is, however, designed to be forgettable, plain, unremarkable, to deflect those human overtures of love, lust or friendship that Shreves just can't be bothered with. Ace's back still turned, San impulsively decides to flex some of her Shreve muscles, puffing her features out into a perfect recreation of the new girl's face. In an instant, and with the crash of a plate of filled rolls falling to the floor, Ace has one of San's arms twisted up behind her back and a buttery knife at her throat. So it's you. You're the Shreve. Okay, Ms. Shreve, we're going for a little walk. And stop wearing my face if you don't mind. It's well weird.
Thinks San, as Ace leads her out through a staff entrance at the back of the hospital.
I really should be more careful with all these reflective surfaces in the kitchen. Ace takes San round the side of the hospital building and across the road to the underground station. She buys them both a single ticket, then leads San through the barrier and down onto the platform. She has linked arms with San in a way that might be construed as friendly to a casual observer, but leaves San in no doubt of the prisoner and escort nature of their relationship. They will, Ace explains, be taking a short journey on the district line with a 10-minute walk at the other end to a secure location where they will meet her colleague. He would rather like a word with San. Ace makes this sound highly ominous. A word. Capital W. And as for any thoughts of trying to escape, resistance is futile. Ace can't resist a smirk when she says this. Of course, her natural Shreve indolence makes San likely to agree with this anyway, but she's also experienced how strong Ace is. Resistance is not an option.
Ace ignores San's attempts to engage her in conversation as they sit opposite each other on the underground train, but San can tell Ace is enjoying this. It is clearly far more Ace's thing than catering. Their destination turns out to be the back room of a betting shop in Poplar. Ace's colleague is an alien, a Time Lord no less, who introduces himself as the Doctor. He's as far from his native planet as San is, but he seems to have made some sort of a base in the small office. As well as filing cabinets, piles of old magazines, packs of small pens and boxes of bundles of betting slips, the room is home to an impressive array of alien technology, its lights flickering and its screens shining. There's even an alien calendar on the back of the door Ace closes and locks behind them, next to the West Ham calendar. The Doctor is sitting at a small desk, as San and Ace enter, reading a sheet of paper from a cardboard file. San can see on the front of the file that its circulation is strictly limited, and it has been issued for the personal use of Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart only. The Doctor, in contrast to Ace's mock sternness, is friendly. He rises to greet San, smiling and doffing his hat. He knows all about Shreeves, he explains, pouring them all a cup of tea. Knows they mean no harm. Knows they have a perfect right to live here. But some business with a Mr. Stephen Harper has been brought to his attention. Something about thefts from offices? Government buildings? Military installations? Ah, yes, thinks San, warming her hands on the cup of tea and sliding her chair back to be nearer the hum of the miniature fridge. Steve Harper, her landlord. The one cloud on her otherwise untroubled horizon. About a year ago, she had accidentally revealed her electricity-absorbing abilities while Harper was making a rare maintenance visit to the flat. Not wanting the inconvenience of his dead body on her carpet, she intervened when he sawed through an electric cable. And since then, San has been persuaded by Harper to help him establish himself as a criminal. Once or twice a month, she has had to de-electrify fences or depower alarms and CCTV cameras so Harper can pursue his fantasy of becoming some kind of gangster spy, stealing and selling secrets. San didn't really mind at first. She's got nothing against Harper's TV villain-inspired aspirations, and the extra electricity has been nice. Harper also made vague threats about eviction if she didn't comply, and she's grown quite attached to her rooms. But it is time to stop her association with Harper, she knows. He's not a very nice man. And while she's happy enough for humans to be either pleasant or unpleasant, he clearly doesn't care who he hurts. And San knows she ought to take a utilitarian view and try to think of the greater good for the creatures who run the planet. The outings are also beginning to get more regular as Harper makes more underworld contacts. And San doesn't like missing out on too much carpet telepath time on her days and nights off. So she readily agrees to the Doctor's plan. Two nights later, San completes another job for Harper. The simple task of temporarily diverting the main supply from the porter cabin office of a security guard firm so that Harper can break in unrecorded by the security cameras and take notes on their employee records. Harper drops San back in the street outside her building before driving to his latest TV thriller-style rendezvous where he will meet his client in an underground car park. Harper has been beside himself with excitement this evening. It seems his new contact is some sort of a Mr. Big. This is what Harper has been waiting for, he has told San. Big league stuff, big time, playing with the big boys. It's an in, it's his ticket, he's arrived. San watches him depart. The contact, Pete Lambert, is already parked up when Harper arrives. He sits waiting in his glossy black BMW. Harper parks his van at the other side of the bay and switches off his lights. He usually waits for contacts to come over to him, but he supposes that with a client of Lambert's stature, protocol might demand that Harper approach him. Lambert certainly shows no sign of moving, or even acknowledging Harper's presence.
Cool,
Harper notes approvingly. He checks that the brown envelope he will pass to Lambert is still tucked inside his leather jacket, even though he knows it is, gets out of the van and walks over to Lambert's car. Lambert still stares straight ahead. He goes on staring straight ahead, even when Harper is standing next to the car. Lambert must know he's there. Harper wonders how long he will be ignored for. Perhaps, he thinks, he's supposed to make some sort of signal. Maybe he should knock on the driver's side window. Or would that offend Lambert? Maybe he... But by this time, Ace, creeping expertly through the shadows, has got close enough to jump Harper. Ace holds him in an arm lock while the doctor emerges from the BMW's back seat. Lambert still stares impassively ahead. Harper starts to reassure Lambert's colleagues that he's not been followed, everything's fine, the raid went off as planned, and he's got the goods as arranged. But he soon forgets all about criminal plans as the doctor begins to talk to him in a persuasive and hypnotic manner. The doctor gives Harper the much better idea of devoting his spare time to charitable work.
Charitable work,
echoes Lambert in a hollow tone, his gaze still fixed ahead of him. Before commencing the investigation of their next case, wherever or whenever that may be, the doctor and Ace call at the temporary office of the retired Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, their contact at UNIT, the secret military organisation who called for the doctor's help with Harper. The doctor reassures the Brigadier that the villainy was all very small time. No criminal mastermind to imprison, no bridgehead of invading alien forces to blow up, and that the case is now well and truly closed. When the time travellers have gone on their way, the Brigadier walks whistling to his car. He has found all this rather tiring. He wouldn't like to do it every day, but nonetheless, very enjoyable. Late that evening, lying by her radiator and rubbing a hand over the carpet, ah, static electricity, San telepathically chuckles with her fellow Shreve, Sal, about their adventure. San playfully admonishes Sal over the subterfuge involved. Was it really necessary for him to pose as a retired unit brigadier and involve a Time Lord of all things to get rid of Harper? No, of course not, laughs Sal, but it was much more fun this way. By the next morning, the story has gone round the whole Shreve community. It's one that will keep them quietly cackling and crackling away for years.